This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
Hi, my name is Fa Sathirapong Sasuti. I am an assistant winemaker of Sunset Cellars and also a manager here at the Tasting Room, which is the Suisun Valley Wine Cooperative.
The concept of the cooperative, by deductive reasoning, it's to give you all a joint momentum, you know, for working together, right?
That's correct.
But it'd be maybe economically too hard to do it on your own.
Right. The co-op, you can think of it in many ways, but in the simplest way is the shared tasting room for three micro wineries. These are three small family-owned wineries that are by themselves too small to have their own operations or to have their own tasting room. So we share resources together. And the co-op has been around in Suisun Valley for a long time. So in some way, I think of it as somewhat of an institution here. Since 2007, Some of the wineries like Sunset Cellars were actually the second winery to put Suisun Valley on the label. And there were at a point as large as five wineries here at the co-op. Some of them graduated, so to speak, to become their own. So the next door winery, Mangles, for example, used to be part of the co-op.
Oh, interesting. So you're involved with the Sunset Cellars people, right?
Yes.
And you're assistant winemaker?
That's correct. And also a second generation owner. So we are learning on the job how to make wine, but also how to communicate wines.
So you grew up in Thailand, and you emigrated to California to go to Stanford when you were about 17, 18?
That's correct.
So in what ways was coming to California an epiphanous moment for you, especially relative to wine? Was wine a part of your life in Thailand?
No, it's not. And I think I'm learning more and more that I'm not unique to this, in that my family is Buddhist, and in Buddhism, drinking is not so well regarded, I guess.
Right.
So I was not growing up around wine or wasn't drinking. In fact, I wasn't even drinking until after college.
Uh-huh.
I went through the whole fraternity system without drinking. Pretty proud of that.
Uh-huh.
But then what got me drinking is my husband, my now husband. So we started dating, and then the first date, he was like, "Are you going to get something to drink?" I was like, "No."
Was this at a restaurant?
It was a restaurant in Japan. And it was really awkward because I knew he wanted to drink. Mm-hmm. But then because I wasn't drinking, he wasn't drinking.
So you were trying to be a good guy.
Exactly. So I felt bad. So I was like, okay, I better learn how to drink.
So what did you order, and was that an epiphanous moment for you?
Well, that night I did not order anything, unfortunately. Okay. But what an epiphanous moment came, I think it was a gradual process. Like many others, I'm an academic and still now am, right? I have a PhD in biostatistics. So thinking analytically is very my thing.
Right.
The first moment was when I was in Boston doing my PhD, went to Harpoon Brewery and Sam Adams Brewery. So the first brewing tour. At the end, they have a tasting, and where that was the first time I get to sit down and be academic about
analytical.
A beverage, right?
Deconstruct
and
it.
Exactly. And when somebody sat me down and say, this is why things taste differently, and then I think it sort of rolled from there when I can learn that, you know, you can taste. I think wine and beer and alcohol in general is unique in that you can taste the difference, the land, the weather, the history, and that what really got me.
Yeah. For some people, a lot of kids growing up, when they first start drinking whatever it is, liquor, alcohol, you know, beer, wine, a lot of them don't like it, but they learn to like it out of social conditioning.
Right.
There are others who immediately think it's the elixir of the gods, you know, and it's this perfect thing they love. When you first had an alcoholic drink like beer at Sam Adams, did you like it, you know, or was it, whoa, what is this stuff?
I feel it's more natural to not like it at first, right? I think they all acquired, just a matter of how fast you acquired or what did you get to learn. So I remember the first time my now husband, then boyfriend, took me to Napa Valley. You know, we stayed at the best hotels, went to a bunch of wineries, including Robert Mondavi. And I remember we went to the reserve room where they serve, you know, $200 a bottle of wine, all the cabernets across multiple years. I chased them all, and it's like, what is all this sour grapes? Right? The only thing I like then was Moscato, mm-hmm. which is sweet wine. And naturally, I think that's a gateway to learning more about wine, to liking more wine. And now we make Moscato. I make Moscato, and I always have a special place in my heart because that is an introduction to wine for me.
But you're not necessarily stuck on a sweet wine.
No, but I like to think that it comes full circle, mm-hmm. right? So you go from sweet wine to white wine to red wine, and then you come back to sweet wine again and say everything is great.
Here we are at the co-op. You're involved with Sunset Cellars. You're assistant winemaker. Tell us about the wines that you guys make that you're most proud of.
Definitely. There are a couple of wines that we're most proud of. I think we identify Sunset Cellars as the classic California style, and that is sort of more robust,
fruit forward.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We're not shy away from the fact that we can grow and ripe fruit properly, and that's what we do. We tend to pick slightly later. We're less concerned maybe about the alcohol. So yeah, Sunset Cellars, we do like the classic California style, and that's a product of the founders, Doug and Cusco Sparks, who grew up drinking wine in that period of the heydays of California style. Except for the one thing, which is they don't like oak, so they don't do the buttery Chardonnay so much.
So stainless steel?
French oak all the way. Uh-huh. So our crown jewels, so to speak, are two wines. I think one is Barbera, which is Northern Italian grapes. We found a very unique vineyard in Napa Valley back in 1997 that has a special clone of Barbera. It has smaller cluster, lower yield. Never really made it to commercial clones, but we actually found it to be very concentrated. We were able to pick it a little bit later and still have the high acid that Barbera still have, and we age it for a much longer time.
So how long?
Currently, we're releasing 2013.
Wow.
As the release. So 8 years in barrel.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is incredible. And
so
that's,
it's worth the wait?
Definitely, because the acid of Barbera is so high and puckery. It's really tart in the first 3 or 4 years. Gotten the chance to, you know, work with and taste some of the younger ones. And it's like, it's kind of nice now, but you wouldn't really want it to drink them. So we age them after about 5 years, it's mellow, and now after 8 years, it's perfect, and it's still going to age for 10 more years.
Wow, that's so cool. You're making me thirsty.
I should give you a taste. And then another wine that we're really proud of is Zinfandel, so Ovine Zin. This one is from Green Valley, and it's from a 90-year-old vineyard.
Wow.
It is one of the oldest vineyards in Solano County where we are. And when people think about Ovine Zin, they think about Lodi, maybe they think about Sonoma Valley, but it's grown everywhere. And this is a testament to the history of winemaking here in Solano County.
For your century-old Zins, the yield is lower, too.
Very low.
So maybe a ton per acre?
Exactly, a ton and a half, a ton. Yeah. And it's head prune. Mm-hmm. If you go look at the vineyard, it's kind of spotty. Some of them are not surviving anymore. But we kept the vineyard. Owner, manager, are kept keeping it for the love of it, right? The piece of history.
With an ancient head prune, Zin, you're kind of stuck with head pruning, right?
The way
it's shaped.
Exactly, but in a way, it's such a beauty. And when you look at when they prune, it's like a sculpture. Mm-hmm. When they have to balance it and think about 2 years ahead of time how it's going to grow, it's just such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, so you don't have the wires like you do in the vertical.
No, not the head prune one. And for that, again, too, it forces it to be a hand-done process. Yeah, you cannot mechanize it.
So it's worth it.
I think so. I mean, the wine,
so
again,
distinctive.
Right. I would say I would invite that you taste the wine, right? And think when you taste it, it's worth it. Every ounce of it, every year that it has accumulated that knowledge and wisdom.
So a little bit more about some of your outstanding wines that you make. Another wine.
Oh, I see. Another wine. So that is another one, Syrah. So we made Syrah. And I remember when I bottled it, you can whiff it in the air, just the smell of the wine getting moved around, and I knew this is going to be like the best Syrah we will make. And I went on and tasted a bunch of Syrah from Washington, from the old world, and always compared to this one, and I feel like it stand up to some of the best. It has all the hallmark of best Syrah, of the dark fruit and the high tone acidity, the meaty smoked meat, barbecue, even a little bit of bacon fat. So it's just has all of the things that you look for. Mm-hmm. And the most surprising thing, and we don't say this so much, is that when we actually get it to test in the lab for the alcohol level, for doing the label design, it came back and we were surprised. It was 17.5%.
Wow. They call that rocket fuel.
I know. I would say you can probably put it in the car and would run. and it's not even fortified. It is a straight up red wine.
But it doesn't have a hot taste.
Not at all. As if I have someone taste.
Paradox.
Exactly. People would taste it like, oh, maybe it's 14%. Mm-hmm. It does feel big, but because of the flavor and the other character that balances it, like you don't feel the alcohol. And that's, again, the same thing that appear in other wines of ours. This tends to be larger or bigger, mm-hmm. but does not feel heavy.
Yeah, because they're well balanced.
Exactly.
Yeah. So have you submitted any of your wines to competitions?
They have over the years. Actually, we used to have a whole case full of medals, and we submitted one that has won gold, double gold every year, is that Barbera.
Uh-huh. And that's at the Chronicle?
Is at a number of things. I think we submitted more to the guild, the Taster Guilds, and the State Fairs. I think those are the ones that we sent.
I was just
going
to ask, some people like submitting to the California State Fair.
Right. I think we think of it as a more, maybe a well representation, a fair representation of California.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. That's so cool. Little bit off the subject, but curiosity has got me. You have a degree in advanced mathematics, and you said you're applying that in your day job. What do you do?
I'm a geneticist.
So really?
Wow. Exactly. So I work for many years. I worked for 6 years at a genetic testing company called 23andMe.
Uh-huh.
You may have heard about it.
Sure,
so you can learn about yourself through your mm-hmm. DNA. You spit in a tube and send it along. And I'm a computational biologist. So I actually look at DNA sequences of people and make association with different traits of different disease. Coming up with estimates. Actually, my best known work is the paper on genetic architecture of sexual orientation
or
sexual attraction.
Wow. Was it a game changer for anybody? Did people shift their thinking as a result of that? Or was it more confirmation?
It was more confirmation. I think by the time our paper came out, I think it's somewhat of a well-recognized fact that it is partly genetic.
Right.
But I think it put a number on that and put the real architectures around that to say that it accounts for about 15 to 25% of the what we call heritability of mm-hmm. the trait. Yet that means that the environmental effects is still there. But even when we say environment, doesn't mean it's a choice. And, you know, well, all of those nuances has to be communicated quite well. Mm-hmm. And I believe we did well with that one. Yeah.
So it's more confirmation in some ways.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Okay, so what is on the horizon in your analytical number world? What, you know, if you could do a game-changing move in science, what would it be? How would you apply that?
This is outside of wine or inside
of
wine?
Yeah, yeah.
Outside
of
wine?
This is dream time.
Oh, I see, dream time. So for myself, I mean, right now what I'm most excited about is actually applying genetics to drug development. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm doing with my day job right now.
So deconstruct, you know, right. How does it apply?
Right. So we can think of genetic, like each of us has a slightly different genes, different functions of the genes. So we can think of each of us as a natural experiment, right? So, and if you say some of us, you might have a better, you know, a more active gene X, and I have a less active gene X, and you can collect a million of these people together and construct a curve that say the more gene X you have, the more risk of certain disease you might have. And if that's the case, knocking it down should actually be beneficial. And that we actually see this with LDL. That's a certain number of genes.
So that'd be interventional preventative medicine, right?
Exactly right. So one of the most exciting things in the field is CRISPR. You may have heard, you know, mm-hmm. Jennifer Doudna had just won Nobel Prize for it. And people are actually using that as a medicine or at the therapeutics approach, rather, in that if you can turn off or on a certain genes that would prevent heart disease or something like that, you can do that once and then you set for life, so to speak. So there are people who are trying to CRISPR those genes off in the right tissues, not the whole body, in mm-hmm. the liver, for example, for
really
cholesterol production.
It.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this, you can do it quite safely, again, with the miracle of CRISPR as a science.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
T-cells?
T-cell is amazing, I think, for cancer, right? Mm-hmm. So people are talking about immunotherapy, teaching T-cells to kill cancers.
I mean, to me, that just seems like a bold frontier in controlling and in being in control, right?
It is, exactly right. So the
how optimistic are you about the future?
Oh, very much so. I think the T-cell, like harnessing immunology technology in fighting disease, has been something we learning to do better more these days. Designing of antibody, as we call it, right? It's really specific. Antibody can recognize all sort of viruses and bacteria, and we can use that to recognize all sort of ailments and proteins that is going wrong and use that to target them. And now the most exciting thing perhaps is the technology that is in the vaccine for COVID vaccine, mRNA, messaging RNA technology that got encapsulated in the lipid droplet. That was a technology in development for a long time, but it was never really proven in a large scale. And all of a sudden, we have millions of people on it.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. And now this is only just the start of that technology. I mean, mm-hmm. it's going to revolutionize so many ways that we are targeting and treating disease.
That's so cool. So there is an upside to downside.
Definitely. I think it's accelerate a lot of the things that is already brewing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it. Okay, well, anything you want to add back on our wine world side,
yes.
closest to your heart?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of innovations, right? So I came, my professional backgrounds as analytical engineering in the high-tech industry of the Bay Area. And a lot of the new energies and new ideas are coming to the Valley and to wine in general. I know for ourselves, for example, we are, for Sunset Cellars, we are launching a club that is going to be quite unique. And for example, when we are running a club in Japan that allows customers to adopt a tree, adopts a vine,
uh-huh.
so you call it Vine Owner Club, and then we send them a picture of their one vines, and then they can check the weather and mm-hmm. the temperature and the humidity all the time. So give people that sense of strong connection.
A friend of mine is doing that in Hawaii with koa trees.
Oh, cool.
And what he does an RFID chip with his tree, so you can watch the growth of your tree from Google's outer space.
Oh, that. Wow. So I see. So you found a Google, like Google satellite mm-hmm. On the image. You can actually pinpoint to which tree
yes.
it is.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do that.
People would love that.
I think so. A vine is pretty small, but
more symbolic anyway.
That's right.
But give them an RFID chip mm-hmm. on their plant. That would
that's
be
true.
Awesome.
I think we should do that. Now, another thing that's cool, I'm not sure, have you been following the NFT, the non-fungible token? This is in the cryptocurrency world.
No.
I see. So this is like one of the hottest things that New York Times, he ran an article about it. And this guy who is a tech reporter in New York Times wrote an article about it and make this token and sell it for...
Oh, the dog token?
For $500,000. No, it's a when we say token, it's kind of like a technology. It's basically a piece of code that is like a certificate of authenticity of certain things. So a lot of people are now selling. It's a way to you make a digital object unique.
Mm-hmm.
So people now starting to look using that in music industry, for example, where you can actually sell music and authenticate that it is not a copy but a real copy,
right.
And then you can actually attach a piece of code to actually give the artist back the money, the kickback from the sales of these things.
So it's approving.
So it's a proof of.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
It's a way to make a digital object unique, and you say it's like this is the real object, not mm-hmm. the clone. And you can actually have a ledger. I mean, the idea of cryptocurrency is that you have this long ledger that shows what's the chain of custody.
Yeah, just don't lose your password.
Basically, that's the idea, right? So, but we're now thinking about linking that back to say this club idea, where you know, if you adopt a tree, you can have an NFT for each of the tree, and you can actually kind of pass it on to another and know who had owned that before you.
Very cool. I love it. So to learn more about Foz World at Sunset Co-op, Susan Valley, tell us where you would go, website.
Yes. So Sunset Cellars is sunsetcellars.com. Oh. So that's fairly simple. The other, we don't have
the co-op?
The co-op is SusunValleyWineCoop.com.
Okay.
But if that's long, you can do svwinecoop.com as well. They're pointed to the same place. But I would invite you or anyone to visit us in person. I think Susun Valley is a beautiful place. It's really close to San Francisco. And the co-op is a really inviting place. One of the unique things is you will find me here almost every weekend. And if not me, you will find one of the winemakers or the owners here, again, because we are small boutique wineries, owner runs. One of the things that's unique about us, but also Susun Valley in general, is that you can find the winemaker, the owner operating, and you can ask deeper questions you like. And this is not a unique, it's a unique opportunity. You don't find that in other bigger regions like Napa Valley.
Very, very cool. Wow, what a pleasure to meet you.
This nice has been to meet great. You, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Fairfield, California. We'll see you here.
It was a large room full of people, all kinds, and they had all arrived at the same building at more or less the same time, and they were all free, and they were all asking themselves the same question.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust preservation initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.